Support for Access Utah comes from the Utah Humanities Council, enriching cultural, intellectual, and civic life by providing opportunities for all Utahns to explore life's most engaging questions and the wonders of the human experience. Hello and welcome to Access Utah. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in studio with me today is Dan Drost, Extension Vegetable Specialist at Utah State University. And if you'd like to join our conversation, we have a toll-free number anywhere you listen to us in the 48 continental United States at 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. You can also send us an email question by going to upr.org. You click on Programs, and then you see Access Utah, and then there'll be an email Access Utah link. Dan, thanks for coming in.
Well, it's good to be here again. It's March. You know what that means.
50 degrees yesterday. I don't know what the temperature got to, but it sure felt good outside my house.
Yeah, and I was actually traveling. I was coming back from a trip, and so when I talked to my wife, Dawn said, "Boy, it's so nice here. I got to get out and do something." And when are you getting home? I said, "Not till a little later." And it was getting cool by the time I got home, but you know, it's pretty nice when it's that way. So today is supposed to be good. A little snow again tomorrow or something, and then improving again. So that's kind of this roller coaster ride that we're on at this time of the year. And you know, you just have to make sure your seatbelt's fastened and, you know, hang on.
Okay, so we have the soil temperatures are rising ever so slightly.
Yep.
The ground is if it's not thawed already in most areas, it will be shortly.
Yeah, I think, you know, if you go around and start poking in there, and, you know, the one way you can always tell is just grab a screwdriver that has a fairly long blade on it and just, you know, go in there and poke around and see. And I think there's quite a bit of frost yet at depth, simply because we had a modestly cold open winter, and so the frost can go deeper into the soil. And certainly anybody that had some flooding up in the Cache County region, you know, early in February, that's a response to that. The ground was hard, the water couldn't soak in, and it caused that flooding. So if you take that screwdriver and just push it into the soil, you can kind of get a sense as to where the frost line is kind of coming. And when you run into some obstruction, you could probably push through it in some cases, but most part it's going to be fairly firm, and that's going to tell you how thawed out things are. It's really in those protected spots that I think we can start to get some things planted. And so I intend this week to, you know, kind of get my planter boxes going, you know, get some greens going in those so that I have some things here. And they're on a south-facing wall. They're up against a brick wall. They're in a raised bed. So, you know, they tend to warm up a little bit faster than other things do. And so I'm going to get some greens done and those kinds of things this week. So
well, then tell me, for those people like myself who still happen to have carrots and beets underneath bags of leaves out in the garden, how much time do I have before I really need to make sure I go out and dig all of those up?
Well, you know, it's still not really that warm. So, I mean, as you start to look at them, if you start seeing some regrowth occurring,
you can always see those little tiny,
tiny little leaves,
hair roots or something.
Yeah, and all those things are indicative of the plant, you know, kind of going into phase two. And phase two is with these biennial types like your beet, like your carrot, like your parsnip, if they're still out there. You know, they're going to want to start to produce a flower stalk now. And so they're going to take energy out of the stored root, put it into that elongating flower stalk, and, you know, then they come into bloom sometime in June. So you got to kind of watch them. You know, if your ground is thawed, if the temperatures are warming, if you start seeing some new leaf growth that's occurring, those are signs that you need to kind of dig them up and you know, start using them up. Because if you leave them out there, then, you know, they're going to do what they naturally want to do, is, you know, go into that reproductive mode that many of our biennial vegetables that we store in the garden want to do in the spring.
I guess if I want to try to hold seed over from one year to the next. I could keep them going. But otherwise, I've noticed in the past that they sure get kind of woody.
Yeah, and that has to do with just, you know, the remobilization of all those sugars and the flavor changes and the whole root structure starts to change as it starts to grow and the plant has to develop a large root system off of the existing root to be able to support that flower development. So that's part of the process that goes on. And, you know, it's getting time where things that are in the garden that have been overwintered there need to be lifted. And we need to be thinking about, you know, prepping it for whatever else we're going to be doing. And that starts here in March. And, you know, if you're in St. George, it's going already. Or if you're in Moab, you know, you're really thinking hard about it because, you know, this is a time in February, late February to early March when, you know, normally we get into that warmer time of the year where we can start seeding many of these crops.
Now, garlic will be one of the first things popping up. Of course, you don't want to lift those, but leave those in until, what, the end of June, first part
of
July?
Yeah, the garlic, you may see some things. Once again, you know, we plant it kind of deep, the idea being that it will have, you know, cold for a longer time down there, make sure that we divide enough cloves, and certainly whether we're growing a hard neck type or a soft neck type, you know, those processes have to go on for a while, and now you'll start, start seeing things push up. You know, I can start to see, you know, I haven't seen any daffodils in my yard yet.
Tulips have shown up in mine.
Yeah, so it depends on where they're located, you know, what the exposure is like, what the soil characteristics are like, but you can start to see the tips of those leaves starting to push through the ground. And, you know, if they're doing it, you know, certainly our garlic is going to do it. So, you know, shortly after those leaves start to emerge is a time when you maybe want to feed them a little bit if you want to get a little bit larger overall bulb size on the garlic. You know, give them a little extra nitrogen at this time, or maybe top mulch them with some, you know, good organic fertilizer that's relatively high in nitrogen. So what that will do for them is that energy then will just kind of soak down into the soil when we get our spring rains. The root system that's already established on that garlic will, you know, absorb that, and then it'll put it into leaf growth, and it'll make those leaves that much more vigorous. And ultimately that then translates into making sure we have plenty of individual cloves within the garlic bulb that fill out and are sizey as we move toward the summer months when, you know, we're going to anticipate our first harvest of those.
Should you feed them more than once?
It's possible that you may want to. It kind of depends, once again, on what our soil fertility is like. If we have a fairly compost-rich soil, they're going to get slowly fed by that. If we have a soil that maybe doesn't have as much organic matter in, it might be useful for us to actually feed them a couple times. Once the leaves start coming up and we start to see them, to make sure that the plant's actively growing and capable of absorbing that. And then another application maybe about a month later. And these could be relatively small amounts. You know, in the range of maybe a third of a cup of, let's say, a 21% nitrogen per, you know, 10 or 15 linear feet of row. And what that'll do is that'll just give that plant the energy that it needs to produce a lot of cloves that are sizey and soft and tasty for us later in the year.
What about those plants that you've overwintered? I'm thinking of my artichokes. I thought, okay, I'm going to try to put these out in the garden, leave them out in the garden. I put big bags of leaves on top of them like I did my carrots. I'm obviously not going to be digging those up because I'm hoping to have a larger bush this year than what I had last year. When do I take those leaves off?
Well, once again, as that soil starts to thaw, we did some work on artichokes for a few years, and we often saw, you know, new leaf emergence about the same time that the asparagus starts to show up. So in Cache County, that's, you know, somewhere in early April, you'll start seeing the asparagus spears starting to push up. You know, the longer you kind of keep them protected, you know, the better. And as we move into the Salt Lake Valley, that could be as late as, you know, late this month in March, that you would start seeing new leaf growth occurring on those plants. And so you got to kind of watch it again. You know, it doesn't hurt once in a while to go lift it up, look at what's happening underneath there. You know, if the plant kind of is etiolated and pushing out and kind of yellowish looking because it's been growing underneath there, there really isn't anything wrong with that. It signifies that you want to get it to the sun so that it can start to produce, and it needs the cold. So leaving it out in your garden is a good thing. The question is, with our open winter, was it too cold for it that even though you protected it, you know, is the growing points, you know, been damaged by just the cold soil that we have? And artichoke is a tricky one. And that's why oftentimes we'll see a few plants that are in the nurseries and garden centers. And the quicker we can get those in and get them started, the better, because it does need this chilling period in order for it to produce flowers. Otherwise, it kind of stays vegetative.
When I was growing up, thought of artichokes as being more of a tender plant, but they're actually somewhat cold hardy if I can keep them out in the garden.
Well, yes and no. They are what we term a tender perennial. So with the right location and with the right amount of protection, you can get them to overwinter. One of the people that I worked with was up in Richmond, and he was able to get a proportion of his plants every year to overwinter. But, you know, he put lots of straw and lots of manure. He put manure on them, you know, just raw manure, thinking that maybe that will generate some heat as it kind of composts. And then threw straw on top of that and lots of leaves. So he had a really thick mulch layer that was maybe, you know, a foot tall or taller. Your idea of, you know, I've got all this bagged leaf material, why not use it as insulation, can work as well. What we really found was when you had the protection and then you also had some good snow cover. And interestingly enough, snow cover is a great insulator because it tends to hold the temperature very close to the temperature, you know, that freezing point. And artichoke can take that. It's when the temperature starts to drop down into like 25 or 20, that, you know, somewhere in that range, that it really starts to damage the plant. And we had some of those conditions this winter. Without a thermometer underneath those bags to kind of see what the temperature was like, it's sometimes hard to say whether we'll get damage. And when you, next month, when you say, oh, yeah, I'm starting to see some artichoke growth, then you can say, oh, yeah, you know, you were successful this year. Yeah, it kind of worked. So.
Okay, you said a word that I am not familiar with. Etiolated?
Etiolate, yes.
Okay.
Etiolate is that extension or that stretching growth that often occurs when plants don't have enough light. So we see that in our tomato plants when we grow seedlings and we have them kind of in this in a south window or maybe a west window or something, and there really just isn't quite enough light for them, and so the plant is kind of stretching toward that light.
Getting leggy?
Yes. We call that etiolated. And plants that are kind of growing underneath in the dark do that. And so our artichoke plant that is sitting under your bags right now, if it has started to push some leaf, your carrot that's out in the garden right now, which doesn't care about the cold so much, it's starting to push some leaf. And when you see that leaf, it's got a very yellow color to it, or maybe a whitish type color to it, because it doesn't have any chlorophyll. It needs the light in order to help make the chlorophyll. But also it tends to get very stretched out. And the horticultural or the botany term is for that is etiolated.
Starts with an E?
Yes.
Okay. That's one I'm going to have to remember.
Yes. Use it in your crossword sometime, you know. It's an interesting word.
You're listening to Access Utah, and if you'd like to join our conversation, Dan Dross, the Extension Vegetable Specialist at Utah State University, is my guest. Our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. Or go online to upr.org, click on Programs, and then Access Utah to be able to send us an email question. So let's talk about what should be planted right now as soon as you can get that ground worked. As we've discussed on this program in the past, you've been a proponent of waiting sometimes to put in, instead of growing them indoors, just direct seed parsnips and onions right into the garden. And why don't you explain again why that works out so well?
Well, the key thing for it is we need for many of these long-duration plants in our garden, we need enough time for them to establish themselves. So the average onion requires 120 to 130 days for it to, you know, mature off appropriately. The parsnips are a very long crop like that as well. So if we can get them established from seeds in the garden, what we find is that they tend to have a more vigorous root system. They occupy more of the soil. The roots penetrate deeper. The plants just grow somewhat more vigorously. And they also have kind of the characteristic of growth that is better when we're trying to store it. In particular, onion is a good example of that. What we find with onion sets or onion transplants, when we put them out in the garden, they tend to produce a fairly large bulb for us, but they also have lots of leaves. They have a very thick neck on them, and we find that they don't store very well when it comes to the winter time. And so what we would advocate for a crop like onion is to seed that crop, and you need to seed it relatively early. Generally, the latest that we would like to plant seeds of onions here in the northern part of the state would be right around no later than maybe the first week of April. So, and then there's some indication that the earlier we can get it in, the better. Just it gives that plant a longer time frame in which to grow. So as soon as we can work the ground, we can put these seeds in. And things that we should be thinking about planting right now would be, you know, anything in the onion group other than garlics. Because if we plant garlic in the spring, what we find is that the plant produces a little bit of a clove, but it doesn't produce a lot. So, you know, all of the other onion things. So, you know, your bunching onions, your green onions, your, you know, get some extra chives going if you don't have those, maybe some leeks. All of those kinds of things are the ones that we want to start seeding right now.
Leeks, easy to grow? I've never grown
them
before.
Yeah, they're not bad. They grow just like onions. You know, the only thing is we'd want to mulch them up or, you know, hill them up a little bit so that we get that white tissue is relatively long because that's the part that we're going to consume. We're not going to eat that greenish leaf part. So all the onion things that can go in the ground. And then there's what we call the leafy greens. So it starts with things like chards and mustards and arugulas and lettuces and spinaches, you know, all of those kinds of things. And there's just so many fun ones that are out there. There's all these neat colors, wonderful leaf shapes. So and more often than not, you're starting to find that the seed companies are just creating what they call blends of different colors and leaf shapes so that there's variety and it makes your salad look really cool.
So you get a packet and it has all different kinds in it and you just plant that.
You just plant that, sow that out, and many of the, then there's these different leaf types. So you've got the the pure leaf lettuce ones, you know, red sails or so, is something like that. You know, they all they do is they just kind of grow leaves. They never really form a head. Then you get the butter crunch types, which are partially heading or semi-heading, we call them. And the head is relatively soft and doesn't pack densely together. And then you have the more upright heading types, which would be the COS, C-O-S types. We see a lot of those in the grocery store. They're a little bit taller and kind of narrow in shape. And then the final one would be, you know, your iceberg types, which, you know, are okay. They're not that flavorful, but they have their place, and they produce a tremendous amount of biomass, but they're only a once-over harvest type thing. And that's why more and more home gardeners tend to grow these leafy types or the semi-leafy types, because they tend to continually produce leaf material for them. You can go in, and as long as you don't cut out the growing point, you just can clip them off, take what you need, make your salad, and then a couple weeks later, they've grown back again, and you can reclip them. So by planting enough, you can go through and say, well, I need to have salads three times this week, or whatever your demand is. I need to have this much for my salads. So I'm going to kind of get into this rotation where I plant X amount of material so that I have enough for a salad, every week.
Well, we have our first caller. Okay. We have Susie in Cedar City. Hi, Susie. How can we help?
Good morning. I so appreciate your program. It's nice to be able to pick people's brains. I live in Zone 5 down here in Cedar City. We're high altitude. So I have a comment and a question. I'll do the comment part first. I've found that a lot of the 100-plus day crops that don't like their roots disturbed, I can't plant in the ground this early because they tend to rot. So what I've started doing, they call me the trash lady at our local elementary school, because I go down there and get all their cardboard cartons from their milk and juices.
Yep.
Try to teach them a little bit about recycling first is repurposing. And I find I can cut those apart so I can start my winter squash and a few of those things that are 110 days early and still not disturb the roots, because I just cut the cardboard off and it doesn't seem to bother them. And I've had real good success with that. And I had a friend, this is my question, has to do with wintering over. She would plant her dahlias on the east side so they got morning sun of the house, and the house protected them. She didn't have to bank them with a lot of leaves. I've never had good success, but I was wondering if you have any advice on wintering over artichokes, if I need to put them not in my garden, but because I know they can grow them down in St. George and I can buy them and stuff, but I've never been able to winter one over. Maybe if I put it closer to my house for protection. I was wondering if you had any advice on that, and I'll hang up and listen to your response.
Okay,
thanks, Susie.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, Susie, two things. I'm going to comment first on what she was talking about, her starts and those types of things. And the key for many of these long season plants, like her squash and things like that, why we have to remember that we have warm weather crops and cool weather crops. So when we're talking today about seeding things, all the crops that we've mentioned so far are cool weather crops. They can take the cold. They can even take a little bit of frost on them without any damage. They require soil temperatures that are much lower in order for the plant to start to germinate or even to grow. That's really critical. For those warm weather crops, the reason we start a transplant for a tomato or a pepper is that now I've been growing that plant already for about 2 months before I transplant it out into my vegetable garden. And what that allows me to do is get a jump on the growing season so that when I do put it out, it wants to go into high growth mode and will eventually start to produce fruit that are ready for harvest in late July through August and into September. So growing them in her little milk cartons, as she was describing, is a great way to do that, because you don't have a plastic tray. They're readily available. We probably have lots of those kinds of containers around the house anyway that are just, you know, being recycled. Well, we can recycle them a different way as well and do exactly what she's saying. So those were great tips for us. Now, related to her artichoke question, we grew artichokes for years up here, and we just found that in the high valleys of the state where we have these deep cold winters, artichoke just really struggles. And the best place that people have had success is to grow it up near a foundation or something like that. Use it as a large accent plant because the type of leaf that it has, a silvery serrated edge to it, is very attractive as a landscape plant. Yet it has a dual function because it will produce this very large flower stalk, and the buds on the end of that flower stalk are what we consume as artichokes. Or if we decide not to do that, we can actually let the plant bloom, and it produces a very, very large thistle-like flower. It's in the thistle family. It's just not a very hardy thistle like the monk thistle or the Canada thistle or any of the other thistles that we have growing wild around this state. But it has that same shape flower to it. It also has those nice purple bloom to it, and it's very large and showy and attractive, so that it has multiple purposes. But the best place that we found to put it is up against the house someplace where it can southern or eastern or western. It really doesn't matter.
Okay.
I've had it at my house on the east side and been successful with it, but it needs to be really close to the foundation. You know, it can't be kind of sitting out in the yard. By close to the foundation, I mean, you know, within 2 or 3 feet of that, because this plant is fairly large when it does grow. The other way that I've had success in overwintering them when I've had them in my yard is in the fall to dig them up like we would our canna lilies or our dahlias or tuberous begonia, something like that, and then put it in a bucket of soil, or usually what I do is some sand, moisten the sand, cut off the leaves, and then stuff it down in my fruit cellar where the temperature is around 38 degrees or so most of the winter. And at that temperature, it's relatively dormant. And then next spring, come back out in late March and then replant it again. It's getting the chilling that it needs to flower both in the root cellar, and because I planted out relatively early back into my flower bed or somewhere in my yard. Now, if you dig it up, it allows you to actually put it any place that you want. That's the nice thing about it. You may just say, well, I want it in my vegetable garden. And the other thing by digging it up, what you can do is it produces offshoots, which they call stumps. That's the term that artichoke growers call them.
Kind of like an amaryllis, how it kind of sticks up another.
Yeah, another little shoot. As long as you can cut that off and then chop off a piece of the root to go with it, you can actually self-multiply the plant. So you can, over time, produce more of these. And
so they're basically just clones.
They're just clonal material. Yeah, exactly. So that the digging up allows you to do that, and to kind of, just like we would divide any perennial, we can divide this one up into various other plants and just expand the number that we're going to be growing. So get it close to the house, mulch it over heavy, the protection that it gets under the eave, and all those kinds of things help. If you have snow in your area, you know, shovel snow on top of it because it's a great insulator, and so you have your leaves and all those other things, and then you pile more snow on it. That's a technique that the Japanese use for a lot of things. If they want to slow things up from growing too quickly in the spring, they don't know what to do with all their extra snow in their cities. The farmers say, bring it out to our farms, and they put it on their fields, and they layer snow on there and pack it so that it melts slowly. And that delays the plant from coming up too early, but it also tends to provide some insulation for them to be able to get through the coldest parts of the winter. So there are techniques that we can use, and I would recommend any of those three.
So I grow dahlias and winter them over from one year to the next by digging them up. So I would, with the artichokes, when I lift up that plant like I would a dahlia, am I going to be seeing that the same sort of, I mean, are there going to be, there's not going to be eyes on this thing.
Well, there will be kind, you will be able to see where there's new shoot development.
Okay.
That occurs quite late. It actually starts putting out secondary shoots late in the fall, and you should be able to see those. And so you could effectively divide up that crown into smaller segments to help make it easier to store and then have extra plants the next spring.
Now, one thing I've been very successful with the dahlia, so now I'm excited about maybe trying this with the artichokes, is I found online a way to wrap the tuber with cellophane.
Oh.
And apparently the holes in the cellophane are just big enough to let oxygen in, but they don't let
too much moisture out.
Yeah. And I went down and checked just last week, and I was just giddy. I've 95% of my tubers are just hard and ready to go for this spring. So I'm thinking, maybe I'll do this with the
artichokes. Normally with dahlias, we don't store them in some type of media. What we did with ours was we dug up lots of them and put them in 5-gallon buckets that we put some sand, moist sand in, and then just stuck them in a root cellar that way. And the moisture in the sand kept the bulb, or kept the crown hydrated, but it wasn't so much moisture that, you know, you could cause rotting or you had standing water. We didn't really want to add water to it. We found that if we had more peat in the mix, it was too wet, so we kind of stayed with, you know, kind of
just
pretty
sand.
Much sand. And
a finer sand or a more coarse
sand? Well, we just, you know, wet up sand and, you know, just kind of poured it in around the plants, and that did a really good job of keeping them hydrated. They started to sprout nicely in there come, you know, this time of the year. In the root cellar, it's warming up even there. They start to want to grow. And then we would just pull them out and plunk them back out in the garden, and they grew great. So that it's a little bit more work, but rather than going out and buying new plants every year, these are bigger plants. Bigger plants produce more flowers, which means more artichokes. So, I mean, you know, to me it makes sense to go through the extra effort, and we know we can't overwinter things like tuberous begonia or dahlias or cannas if we just leave them out in the garden. So we have to dig those up anyway. Why not dig up this ornamental plant as well and not only have it as a specimen plant in your flower bed that looks, it's gray, you know, the grayish color of the leaf, it's really quite attractive. And then that big old flower stalk, it really makes it, you know, pretty interesting. So that's what I would recommend.
Yeah, it's always kind of fun when someone comes
What's that?
What is that? It's an artichoke. You can grow those here? Yeah. Well, of course you can.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're going to go on to the next edition of Wild About Utah, and then we'll be back for the rest of the hour with Dan Drost, USU Extension Vegetable Specialist.
Welcome to Wild About Utah, a partnership of the Stokes Nature Center, the Bridgerland Audubon Society, and Utah Public Radio.
This is Linda Curvin for Bridgerland Audubon Society. No songbird can be led to water, and you certainly cannot make them drink. But give them a bird bath, and many birds will drink and bathe with gusto, especially here in the arid West. As a yard ornament, the idea is not so old. The word bird bath was first coined in the Gilded Age. At our bird bath, robins daily crowd the rim, as many as 6 at a time, alternately bobbing and thoughtfully swallowing. Few birds can suck in water with their beak immersed. Instead, they lift their head with a beak full of water, which they drink down in a few gulps. The gray Townsend solitaire, another regular visitor, perhaps needs to wash down its winter diet of dry, tangy juniper berries. Birds like to bathe even in winter. Just why they bathe is not so obvious. Cleaning their insulative layer of down may keep it fluffy to trap maximum heat. After bathing, birds often nibble their flight feathers. This preening removes dirt, feather detritus, and parasites while realigning each feather's barbs so that they lock together for flight. Feathers repel water not by oils, but through their fine structure. Some game birds, such as quail, take dust baths, squatting in a shallow dirt scrape to ruffle loose dust through their feathers. When quail were experimentally denied dust baths, their plumage became greasy and disheveled. Bathed preen birds are dapper. So what features make a good bird bath? It should be shallow, just an inch or two deep and placed 2 feet or more above the ground to thwart terrestrial predators. A nearby preening perch is helpful. The bath should be convenient to refill, both because bathing birds splash a lot and also because changing the water frequently deters disease transmission. Our bird bath mounts to our deck railing and has a low-wattage heating element that prevents freezing. If you are already feeding birds, consider adding a bird bath. The exuberance of a bathing bird is a joy to behold. This is Linda Kirvin for Bridgerland Audubon Society.
Wild About Utah is a partnership of the Stokes Nature Center, the Bridgerland Audubon Society, and Utah Public Radio. For transcripts and archived audio of Wild About Utah, go online to upr.org and click on the Wild About Utah link. Support for Wild About Utah comes from the College of Natural Resources at Utah State University. Information is at cnr.usu.edu.
Hello, welcome back to this second half of Access Utah. And actually, there's only about 20 minutes left in the show, so if you'd like to get in a question or comment, call our toll-free number at 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. We also have a way for you to email us your question. Just go to upr.org, click on Programs, and then Access Utah, and you'll see the email link. And then at the end of our program today, we have Melissa's Gardening Moment. I believe the next edition of that one as well. So a lot going on this Monday. And the first thing that I need to do is say hello to Margot in Los Angeles. Margot is the mother of someone who lives here in the Logan area and listens to the gardening segment of Access Utah. So thanks, Margot.
It always amazes me how far afield we can go with our information. You know, that's the beauty of whether she's listening online or... You know, sometimes I know, and I'm driving around, I can pick up radio stations from literally hundreds of miles away, and you go, I wonder where that's coming from. And then it says, oh, we're out of San Francisco, or we're out of so-and-so. And so good for Margo. Welcome today.
Well, we appreciate having, in fact, if you have a question, call in. Hey, yeah, you can talk about artichokes.
That would be a first to get someone from L.A. to call us.
Well, I wanted to ask really quickly, just backing up to our onion discussion, about the caution. If you do start your onions indoors, the caution about not transplanting them outside too soon.
Yeah, you know, if... That's always a big issue. And if you started them today, let's say you seeded them for transplants, they would be about ready about the right time to transplant out. Normally, we don't like to put onion sets or transplants out into the vegetable garden until around the middle of April. You know, and the reason for that is we still have some cold weather that's going to show up here, and we're going to have nights that are cool and days that aren't so warm. And what happens with those plants that are a little bit larger, if we get them too much chilling, then sometimes they start to produce flower stalks in the year, which we want them to bulb up. So they don't bulb, but they produce a flower stalk, and then they're really not usable to us in any way.
So they've had the warmth of the home, and they think that's the first year, and then they go out, and then
it's
too cold?
Not like that. It's just that the plant is large enough that it can be induced to produce a flower stalk.
Okay.
So with the seeded ones, interestingly enough, that doesn't happen because the plants aren't large enough, and they're germinating and they're starting to establish themselves, but by the time we get into mid to late April, they're still relatively small compared to our transplants, but the weather is good enough then that they no longer are induced to want to produce a flower stalk in the first year.
So is it the chilling then that
it has
that?
A chilling type of effect, yes.
Okay.
And you have a plant that has been grown for 1 year, because essentially an onion set was planted very, very thickly last year and produces little tiny mini onion bulbs, and we're really planting a crop that's a year old. With a transplant, we're planting one that's just planted this spring, but it's a lot more mature than the seeded ones that we're going to plant out here sometime in March. So if your garden is warm enough, if your site is dry enough so that you can get in and start seeding those, yeah, go ahead and seed them. It's going to take a little while for those to germinate because the soil temperatures aren't, you know, at the optimum for germination, but they're at the minimum necessary for germination each day. And so they'll start to tick along and do the things that they're supposed to do. And, you know, by the end of this month, you'll have the little seedlings established and growing, and they're going to do just great. So get those greens out, you know, here as soon as we can get some work done in the garden. One way we can speed up that whole process, as we've talked before, is we can put floating row covers over top of them, or we can put a little plastic tunnel or something like that in order to just capture some more temperature, heat up that process a lot faster. That's what I'm going to do when I seed mine. I've just got a frame, an old screening frame, and I put plastic on that, and it then becomes like a mini greenhouse. I just lay it up against the side of my house in the planter box that these things are going to grow in. It provides some protection as well so that the cats don't get in there and, you know, scratch around and do what cats do. So all of those things then, you know, will allow me to get some of those greens really established a lot quicker. And I'm basically going to focus my attention this year just on salad type things and a mix of lettuces, you know, some spinach, probably some mustards and those types of things, so that I got a variety that will go into the salads that we make. And it'll be an area that's about 3 feet wide by, you know, maybe 5 or 6 feet long, and planted in rows relatively close together so that I can just kind of clip out the rows that I want when I need to make a salad and work from there.
So now if I have, say, a 5x5 area that I just didn't get to last year to get tilled in, and I've got leaves on the top, how do I speed this process along? Can I take black or clear plastic and put it down and kind of leave the ends open a little bit so the moisture can get out?
Yeah, sometimes if we just seal the edges there, you know, it'll start to heat up underneath there, but there's no place for really the moisture to go. We need to, you know, kind of get some of that surface moisture off of it so that we can work the ground. So, yeah, just by creating a little tent with some openings on the end, what that'll do is as it warms up underneath there, that warm air will escape and it will help the soil dry out so that you can then work it a little bit more quickly.
But, of course, not big enough to let the cat in, so.
Well, you know, yeah, I don't know. You know, sometimes you know how cats are. You know, they get where they get. And we have a few run around the neighborhood, and they, you know, so you just have to kind of protect yourself from them.
Well, we only have about 11 minutes left in the program to get in your question or comment. It's 800-826-1495, or go to upr.org. and send in your email question by clicking on programs and then Access Utah. And we have a question from Andrea in Logan. She said, she has a quick question about seed viability. She said, I just got excited about going out to plant onion seeds in my garden today. I have some seeds left over from last spring. Will they still be viable? If you could discuss seed viability for some of our spring plantings like onions, lettuce, spinach, and carrots, that would be great.
Yeah.
Thanks, Andrea.
Yeah, that's a good question. Seed viability, it's two ways to think about it. A, we can either test the seed to see how many germinate. We can do that indoors in a warm place. You could take 20 seeds, put them in a paper towel, moisten it so that it's moist but not wet, enclose it in a Ziploc bag, leave the bag so that it's not sealed up, but so the moisture can kind of get in and out of there. And then put it in a warm place, like on a kitchen counter, or I like to stick them right on top of the refrigerator because there's a lot of heat that comes off the back of the refrigerator. And And then in a few days, just count how many seeds have germinated. And from that 20 seeds, you can calculate what your germination percentage is. If all of them germinate, it's 100%. If none of them germinate, it's 0%. So that's one way to test viability. The other thing to remember is seeds, like if we've stored them appropriately. So if you've just been leaving them out in the basement, those aren't really the most appropriate storage conditions for seeds. So we may find that the seed viability has been lost. So, but if you've been storing them in a cool, dry place where the moisture doesn't change that much, those onion seeds could be planted again this spring. What I always recommend if we're holding seeds from year to year, things like tomatoes and peppers and some of the melons and stuff, they don't lose their viability very quickly. But some of our leafy greens, things like carrots, certainly things like onions and parsnips, they may decrease the germination percentage by 50% in 1 year. So last year, you know, if 100% of them came up, it could be only 50%. You can plant them this year, just sow them really thick. That's the thing. And then come in after they're up a ways with the green onions. One of the things that I do, I always plant mine very thick anyway. And then I just pull out plants as I need them for salads. And I use them as green onions. And then the remnant of them would be left in the garden once you get your right spacing, let's say a 3-inch spacing or a 2.5-inch spacing. You thin them out to that as you go along, and you use the product for your dinner table. So, yeah, go ahead and plant those seeds, and if it's the leafy greens and stuff like that, really doesn't matter if they're too thick, because I just do leaf clipping anyway and, you know, let the plant regrow again. And so if it's thick, it doesn't really matter. You want plants.
We have a next caller from Moab. We have Darlene. Hi, Darlene. How can we help?
Really love the sweet pea flower, and we used to grow them real well in California.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd really like to try it here in Moab. What do I do?
Well, it's no.
I bought some sweet pea seeds late last summer over
okay.
in Grand Junction.
Yeah,
so.
Good. What I would recommend you do is, you know, get them, you know, kind of pre-sprout them. Don't plant them out too early. You know, so down in your area, you know, toward the end of the month. But normally I sprout my pea seeds indoors, and then I see which ones are actually growing, because not all of them germinate,
mm-hmm.
and then just plant the ones that have the little root coming out of them. You need to handle them a little bit more carefully, but you'll be then insured to get plants, and then only plant them about an inch deep, and you should be good with them, because sweet peas, my neighbor has them, and he never really even replants them from year to year. They self-seed themselves, and they come back up every year. So once you get them established, I think you'll be good. So it's this first year, sprout the seeds and plant those. And
now, do I just do them on a...
Yeah, in some paper towel or something like that.
Okay, all right.
And just so the root starts to show out of the seed, and then have your site prepared. And it should take about 7 days or so for those things to sprout, maybe a little quicker depending on how warm it is. So
mm-hmm.
toward the end of this month is a good time to get them in down there.
Okay.
Good luck with that.
Thank you. I so enjoy your program.
Oh, thank you, Darlene.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, so we've only got a few minutes left, and I really wanted to talk about leafy greens, especially lettuces.
Yep.
How do you decide? There are hundreds and hundreds of varieties. How do you decide what to get?
It depends on what I like. And what I've been buying lately is just a mix. And it's a spring green mix. And it will have mustards in it. It will have
arugula.
Okay. It will have red leaf types. It will have the green leaf types. It will have ones that have serrated edges. It will have ones that are looking all different types of things. And all they're trying to do is just create variety.
So it's just leafy, though. You aren't going to have any heads that are forming.
I don't try any of the head types. A little later, I'll start planting some bibs, because I do like some butter crunch or bib types. But it's still a little too early for those. And that's what I sow. You can either make your own, just buy a mix of every different kind that you like and just kind of mix the seeds together. or you can plant them out in individual rows. I've gotten lazy. I don't want to have to pick too much. I just go in and clip what's out there, and it has all these different colors and all these different leaf shapes. And, you know, some that are kind of spicy because there's some mustards in there, and it's good to go for me. I'm
a little more simple.
It's simple and lazy. I call it, you know, you got to be a lazy gardener as much as anything.
Now, do you just look for a spring mix, or do they have different mixes so you can at least choose a little more spicy?
Yes. You can get whatever you want, and that's really what's fun about this. You know, you can make your own mixes, or you can just go and buy kind of what's available. And if you go, like you say, purchase a seed catalog, there are literally hundreds of varieties of lettuces available, just lettuce, equal numbers of all different kinds of things. So, you know, there's almost too many choices nowadays for us. And so you just have to experiment a little, and, you know, it'll work out. That's the beauty of it. These plants will grow. They all grow here. They'll all do okay here. Just get out there and have some fun with it.
Okay, so if we decide to go with individual varieties, we were talking during the break about how the reds tend to last a little longer in the garden. They don't bolt quite as readily as some of the green.
Yeah,
the green
and leafies. if you purchase from a seed catalog or something like that, sometimes it's good to go online and look at some of the seed catalogs that are available, because they do also have slow bolting types. And those slow bolting types are the ones that will tolerate the heat of summer and the long days of summer, which drive other varieties to flower prematurely. So, yeah, you just have to look and read. And, you know, I don't pick varieties for people because they don't like what I like and I don't like what they like. So you just have to experiment.
Do you tend to sacrifice flavor or something else to get those that don't bolt as early?
I can't say that I've ever read anything that really looked at that component of it that closely.
Okay.
So I kind of go for visual appeal. I want to have different colors. I want to have different leaf shapes. And then the flavors come in from things like the arugulas and the mustards, and those give it the spiciness that, you know, kind of adds some uniqueness to your salad. And so, you know, just go out there and experiment this year.
We tried arugula for the first time a couple of years ago, and my wife had it straight, and it was way too peppery, but she mixed it in with some of the leafy greens, and she loved it.
Yeah,
it was really
it's
good.
Great. It's a nice addition.
Well, we've reached the end of our time. Dan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Access Utah. Dan Drost is Utah State University's Extension Vegetable Specialist. He's been with us for the entire hour, and we'll be back the first Monday of every month through the growing season. Thank you for joining us on this edition of Access Utah.
Vertical or wall gardens are all the rage. They green up otherwise unplantable spaces and can even help conserve energy. Hi, I'm Melinda Myers, horticulturist and gardening expert. You can make your own or buy one of the vertical planting systems now in the market. Flexible hanging containers like Woolly Pockets are designed to mount on walls. Some are designed specifically for indoor use and have built-in water barriers to prevent damage to furnishings. Simply fill the bottom of the pocket with a well-drained potting mix. Place the transplants inside the planter with roots touching the watering wick. Cover the roots with potting mix and water. Or create a true green wall with a vertical or wall container. Some, like Grovert wall planters, have a watering mat to ensure every section is evenly watered. I like to use a variety of drought-tolerant, low-growing hens and chicks and other succulents for low maintenance. Plus, the variety of color and textures makes for a great display. Check out our website for this and other gardening tips.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.
Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
For information on events across the state, visit our website, upr.org. The time is 10 o'clock.